Welcome to Oncology Today, Novel Immunotherapeutic Strategies in the Management of Melanoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Omid Hamid from the Angeles Clinic and Research Institute in California. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding program featuring Dr. Hamid's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to describe his approach to frontline therapy for patients with metastatic melanoma.
So when I see a patient who presents with unresectable or metastatic melanoma, I do ensure that they first of all have the appropriate workup. And the appropriate workup is a full body staging, a brain staging, so an MRI of the brain to ensure that we don't have brain metastases, as they can occur synchronously in up to a third of the patients. I ensure that next generation sequencing has been sent to clearly, a standard is to at least know the BRAF status, wild type. And then I take a quick overview of their physical status. So that's the performance status. Obviously, age sometimes factors in it, but rarely if performance status is maintained. Multiple trials have shown that age is just a number and performance status dictates how you do on therapies. So the first thing is you've done the staging and you have a patient who has brain metastases. Clearly, we've seen that there are three regimens that work on brain metastases. If it's BRAF mutant, BRAF inhibitors work on brain metastases. If not, or even if it is, single agent PD-1 has a 20% response rate. And then what the standard is combination CTLA-4 PD-1 therapy has a 55% response rate and is the right first option if it is manageable. And by that, I mean, if the patient does not have severe symptomatic disease that requires steroids. Why is immunotherapy better than BRAF MEK targeted therapy? It's because what we've seen in our experience is, even though the response rate is high, the durability is only 5 months, 6 months in the brain. In the body, dual targeted agents, 14, 16 months, etc. So brain mets is the first thing. If a patient has significant symptomatic brain mets requiring steroids, but the question is really if you can resect an area to make them independent of steroids, that's a different talk. The second portion of the discussion is, what is their BRAF status? Because through multiple studies, whether it is Checkmate 67, whether it's DreamSeq that I mentioned earlier, the combination of anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1 therapy in its full dosing showed improved progression-free and overall survival in BRAF mutant patients in high-risk and low-risk subsets. So in my BRAF mutant population, I don't give single-agent PD-1. I give combination CTLA-4 PD-1. And in that setting, I favor a CTLA-4 PD-1 regimen. That leaves the rest of the people. And the rest of the people get an extensive discussion about the toxicities of each regimen and how they're given and where we go. Mucosal and acrals, we tend to lean more to CTLA-4 PD-1 combos. And uveal is outside of this discussion, of course. And then we then discuss the side effects seen. Now, here's a caveat. With those patients that the PD-L1 is greater than 1% in subset analysis, and for me, those patients who are wild type and PD-L1 that is greater than 1%, single agent PD-1 inhibition is considered a standard. It is definitely outside of the United States, where the multiple countries will not allow you to give nivolumab, relatlimab, if the PD-L1 is greater than 1%. We have a long talk with patients, and then I sprinkle in clinical trials here where you can see you can give the triplet, quadruplets, other combinations, the fianlimab, cemiplimab combination. And then we have done a great job talking about second line therapies.
So before we kind of go through that, one thing that you mentioned was PD-1 level. And I have this sort of macro view of melanoma investigators that they don't look at PD-1 levels.
That's true. We don't look at PD-1 level at all.
Well, you just said that if you, greater than one, you single agent.
I would say greater than one, it is fair to think about given other comorbidities, single agent. There is a subtype also that has a high response rate to immunotherapy, and single agent may be appropriate. Those are the desmoplastic melanomas. They have high mutational burden and respond about 70% to single agent versus 30 to 40% in the other subtypes of melanoma. My gestalt is to discuss, the indicators of clinical trial enrollment, because we've seen that that's the best way to understand the next line of therapy and try to give maximal benefit first line. And then, of course, it is an extensive discussion where we hope to come to a resolution and an option within the first visit.
So one other thing, not to get too far out in a tangent, but I just have to bring it up. So you mentioned the idea that your approach to immunotherapy is different in patients with BRAF mutant disease versus BRAF wild type, if I understood what you just said correctly. In addition to that, I saw some data at ESMO. Patients who had high PD-1s did better with BRAF therapy. Am I right?
Right. So that's based on this idea that the BRAF inhibition is not just a targeted agent, that there is some immunomodulatory, effects there. And that's a very interesting idea. And it's what you possibly have seen are subset analysis from these trials that are looking at triplet combinations of BRAF, MEK, and PD-1, which are not standard at this time.
What do we know about those triplets?
Well, what we know about those triplets is that in randomized trials, there was no clear benefit to give those triplets. What we know about those triplets was that there was early consideration that they may help with patients who have brain mets, and that still hasn't panned out. There are clinical trials that are ongoing looking at those triplets in patients with brain mets and randomizing them to compare them with the combination of ipilimumab, nivolumab to see which one is best for patients with BRAF mutant brain metastases. The triplets at this point, there is one that is approved, femurafenib, cobimetinib, atezolizumab, based on a trial that we were part of, which showed progression-free survival benefit by investigator. Unfortunately, central review and other similar trials did not support that, although that led to an FDA approval. Very few people utilize that as an appropriate first-line therapy for their patients.
And in what situations do you use BRAF therapy, BRAF MEK therapy first line, if any?
Great question. And my utilization of BRAF MEK therapy are for those patients who are extremely symptomatic and have high tumor burden. I don't utilize the triplet as much as I utilize a regimen, but it is a quick 2 months of BRAF MEK therapy for patients with high tumor burden, impending visceral failure, central nervous system metastases that is symptomatic, requires steroids, etc. 2 months, and then a flip into a dual checkpoint inhibitor if possible. And there is a lot of indication that utilizing BRAF MEK and riding it until tumor resistance can lead to a poor immune response. So Succombit, which was presented at ESMO 2022 and 2021, is a trial that looked at regimens in BRAF mutant patients. It looked at starting with checkpoint inhibitor and transitioning to targeted agents on progression, or starting at targeted agents and transitioning to dual checkpoint inhibitor upon progression, but also had another cohort, which was called a sandwich cohort, which started with, 2 months of BRAF and MEK inhibitor going into combination checkpoint inhibitor, and then with BRAF inhibitor at progression. And that was as viable as starting with immunotherapy, but also in that trial, starting with targeted agents was the worst regimen. I utilize that in our patients who are BRAF mutant, who have huge tumor burden, who cannot get first-line immunotherapy, or at a symptomatic, or at risk for visceral failure.
This trial that you just mentioned, it sounds like DreamSeq. Was it a phase 3 trial?
It wasn't as big as DreamSeq. It had about 60 patients in each arm. Now, what's the benefit of that trial? Well, the benefit of that trial that was conceived and run by Paolo Acierto, who's in Naples, Italy. The benefit of that trial is going to be all of the correlative work, the tissue correlates, the predictive, the prognostic, what's happening with the circulating tumor DNA, and where that goes. As you can see, DreamSeq was an ECOG trial, and ECOG utilized multiple centers and multiple community centers. So I'm talking to all of my brethren in the community. You can do trials, and you can do them well. And so the idea in requesting blood and tissue and all of these correlates was difficult in that number of patients. So DreamSeq is going to come and it's going to, fix the rough edges, as per se.
So actually, as I was asking that question, when would you start first-line BRAF? Actually, as I asked it, I was thinking to myself, well, people have contraindications to IOs, autoimmune disease, transplants, et cetera. So yeah. I'm kind of curious what your sort of bar is for, that kind of history using immunotherapy where somebody has a brain met, you really want to use combination immunotherapy. How much, let's just start with prior autoimmune disease. How much prior autoimmune disease do you have to have for you not to use immunotherapy?
If I could just back that up and say, hey, when I see a patient who is immunosuppressed, a patients with CLL end up having melanoma, have an autoimmune disease, right? Ton of patients with rheumatoid, et cetera, show up at my door or have had a transplant. And we're looking at a lot of that data, and some of it comes from the group at Dana-Farber and also the group of Hopkins have presented their cohort of patients. But when I see a patient like that, we have an extensive discussion, and I get their transplant physician or their rheumatologist involved and try to, number one, decrease the amount of immunosuppression. So a lot of patients on transplant are not on mTOR inhibitors. They're on steroids. So a phone call to their doctor to say, hey, can you move these patients onto mTOR inhibitors, limit the amount of immunosuppression, and then go from there. The second point is a discussion about what's the alarm, okay? How dire is the circumstance? And then we discuss, are those patients with transplant willing to risk their allograft, right? And you'd be surprised how many patients don't want to go back on dialysis. And it's also interesting how many patients just say, doc, go for it. So that's the second part of it. And then the third part of it is a discussion about really how many people really risk there and what is it. And for me, initially, it's a 50-50 proposition. You have a 50% chance of really exacerbating these therapies. Now, what have we learned? Is that some of the drugs that are used for immunosuppression are utilized and have efficacy There are multiple patients that have gone through immunotherapy and not had rejection. We monitor, and then at the earliest sign of something happening, we may then increase the immunosuppression. I will say two things, that melanoma is a highly mutated tumor, and that there are drugs that target, about 70% of melanomas have targetable mutations that are not, in the majority are not BRAF, so I'd look for other targeted agents. For some patients, local injectables like oncolytics have a role. But if your back is up against it, we have a discussion and initiate therapy.
So I want to maybe start to use these cases to kind of get into some more issues. These cases, actual patients, are more theoretical scenarios.
I think they're actual patients. I mean, I see patients like this every single day.
So this was a specific patient that you took care of?
This is a very common scenario for patients with melanoma. Oh, I had something cut off 10 years ago. It was small. I saw my dermatologist. Nothing showed up. I had a cough. I got an antibiotic, or I got a node that appeared under my neck, and I got an antibiotic. It didn't get better. They biopsied it. It was melanoma. They scanned, and I had metastatic disease, and then we moved forth in the way that we discussed.
So you mentioned before that you typically get NGS on these patients. Other than BRAF, what are you looking for? What is helpful?
So these are not standard things to look at. Tumor mutational burden is helpful to understand who can respond to therapies. We have a great protocol that's approved. Here, it's the TAPUR protocol, T-A-P-U-R, through ASCO. Maybe you wanted to shout out to Ed Kim, who's at City of Hope right now, who's led some of this stuff at ASCO. And these are drugs like CDK inhibitors that are approved for other solid tumors that are open to any solid tumor that harbors those mutations. There are PARP inhibitors for patients who have HRD mutations. There are very, very low subset of patients who have ROS mutations that you can use some of these inhibitors that you use for lung cancer. So that's what we do. The New England Journal of Medicine phase one study that led to NTRK inhibitors had two patients that harbored NTRK fusions that were melanoma that got huge benefit. Now, we move around and have multiple different badges we wear that identify us, right? I'm a community oncologist. I'm a community oncologist. I see about 100 patients in my clinic a week. I'm an academic oncologist. Yeah, I run clinical. I'm an academic oncologist. I'm an immuno-oncologist. Yeah, I use immunotherapy. We've helped develop them. I'm a molecular oncologist. I look at the NGS and utilize it. But I would challenge you and all of my colleagues to realize that we're at any given time for each different patient, we are some machination of all of those four identities. And it's interesting to see patients that come to see me, whereas in the past they would have never had an NGS, that they do now, and there are multiple places that can partner with you, and I don't have to say their names, we all know them, that if you work at a place that does not have its own internal system, that you can send tissue out utilizing that information for options for patients in the future.
So let's go back to this sort of first line scenario. I guess one thing just before you even get started is, again, getting back to the issue of PD-1 and TMB. So do you look at either one of those? Because a lot of times when I talk to melanoma investigators outside a clinical trial, they'd say, I don't even look at it, even if they've had it done. But it sounds like in your algorithms, it maybe does have a role. So do you look at PD-1? Do you look at TMB?
I look at it to talk to a patient about their chances of responding to a regimen. I never tell a patient if they're PD-1 negative or low TMB that they have zero chance of responding. Literally, you know, I could tell you, you have a 90% chance of responding, but if you're a part of that unfortunate 10%, you're not happy with me. And if you have a 15% chance of responding, where multiple solid tumors have with a checkpoint inhibitor, if you're part of that 15%, and I got a ton of them that are with other solid tumors, including ovarian, you're very happy with me. What we've understood is that the possibility of combination immunotherapies can overcome some of the limitations of response that we see with single agent checkpoint. And that's the reason why we have our phase one clinical program here at the Angeles Clinic and Research Institute. And that's what I discuss with the patients that come through.
All right. Well, let's kind of go through the alternatives that you typically will bring up nowadays to a patient in this first line situation. Let's start out because, you know, as you've been talking, I see, BRAF mutant versus wild type's an issue. Also, you know, PD-1 in terms of monotherapy may be a consideration, but also the presence or absence of brain mets. But in any event, so let's start out with the scenario you have right now, which is BRAF wild type brain MRI negative. Can you talk about right now, what are the options you think through for a patient like that, both clinical trials as well as outside of clinical trial?
Right. So the options that that we have are different than multiple other centers. But if someone showed up here, that we would look for that patient an option with a regimen with a PD-1 backbone. So whether that's fianlimab, cemiplimab versus cemiplimab, first line randomized national international trial, whether that's the sorry quad trial that I talked about, which was ipilimumab, nivolumab, relatlimab plus sarilumab. So I would offer that to them as a clinical trial option. Possibly those patients that need to avoid some toxicity and therefore would avoid CTLA-4. We have first-line trial with anti-PD-1, anti-LAG, and an anti-TIM-3 antibody. So I would offer that to them and move forward. If not, if they were not interested in clinical trial, then the discussion about Rela-Nivo or Ipi-Nivo would come into discussion, and then we would go from there.
At this point, in what situations, if any, are you using single agent IO?
Single agent IO for possibly poor performance status, definitely a patient who has autoimmune disease, post-transplant, etc. In an extensive discussion with a patient who has desmoplastic melanoma, which has a high response rate to a single agent. We're not done with single agent PD-1. We just are utilizing it earlier and earlier. So those are the three that come to mind. Subcutaneous, so M1A disease, which is dermal, subcutaneous, and nodal alone. There are combinations with oncolytics where it's a local therapy.
I was just thinking in terms of IO alone as opposed to LAG-3 plus IO. Why would you not give LAG-3?
Very, very minimal. Very, very minimal. Possibly desmoplastic patient. Otherwise, I offer it to the majority of my patients.
I take it that there's not much evidence that you see much more toxicity by adding LAG-3?
Very small bump. It's specifically in the fianlimab, cemiplimab, the the major increase that we saw was in fatigue and adrenal insufficiency. So those are very manageable.
What data do we have on cemiplimab monotherapy?
In melanoma, not a lot, but one would expect that it would perform the same way, although it's not approved and there are no clinical protocols utilizing it. We've seen, you know, of course, in other solid tumors, including the cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, high response rates similar to what we've seen with other PD-1 inhibitors approved in that setting.
Any practical or theoretical differences between LAG-3 agents, for example, RELA versus fianlimab?
Right. Just to say that it's an interesting, if you look at the fianlimab dosing, it's 1,600. And if you look at the relatlimab dosing, it's 160. That's a higher, we dosed higher with the LAG-3 there. Is that the reason why we're seeing higher response rates? We can't really tell. Obviously, because we have data that comes from an 80-patient experience where they have phase 3 data. So phase 2 versus phase 3, I would not make generalization. Will we know that answer? Yeah, we'll know that answer when the randomized first-line trial accrues because we'll have hazard ratios and we can compare head-to-head.
Can you talk a little bit about the data we have right now on using LAG-3? I guess it's mainly RELA, the clinical trial data, and the improvement, the degree of improvement that you see by adding it to Nivo.
10% increase in response rate, a improvement in progression-free survival. Really not a great response rate in the post-PD-1 setting. The hazard ratio is not significant in the PD-L1 greater than 1% setting. It's beneficial in other subtypes, including BRAF. It's a well-tolerated combination, and that's what we've been looking for. The grade 3 or 4 toxicities, which were 54% with ipi/nivo, 33% with flip dose ipi/nivo, and it's in the teens with rela/nivo. So in a busy practice or for patients where you're trying to keep them out of having toxicities, it is one where it's become, you know, the go-to.
So certainly, particularly with younger patients, I think a lot of people are thinking about ipi/nivo, but because we don't really have a comparison to rela/nivo, indirectly, how do you make the comparison? I get the feeling that the thinking is that ipi/nivo has more efficacy, but what are the actual numbers?
Well, ipi/nivo has more data. It's got more long-term data, right? It's got 6.5 years, you know, data there. So some patients come in and they go, I want the one that's, you know, been there, done that. Aside from that, the way that you can make, you know, comparisons head to head is utilizing hazard ratios from trials that compare to the same arm. And Checkmate 67 and Relativity 47 compared to single agent nivolumab. And when you look at those hazard ratios, it's similar in all subgroups except for the BRAF mutant, where there's an indication that ipi/nivo has a better benefit.
So is that sort of your algorithm then, that if they're a BRAF
That's
wild
part
type,
of my algorithm,
you think about?
Yes. If they're BRAF mutant, I really, really am tied to full dose ipilimumab with nivolumab as per the approval.
So let's talk a little bit about second line therapy in these situations. Let's talk about second line therapy after first line ipi/nivo and second line therapy after rela/nivo. Can you talk about, first of all, how you would think this through outside a clinical trial And then what are some of the clinical trial strategies that you think are most interesting to consider?
Right. I'll start with the other, the latter first and then the former second. Clinical trial strategies that I support, as I've shown today, are adoptive T-cell therapy, ImmTAC bispecifics, and then immuno-immuno combinations going forward. We've seen high response rates and durability from John Hannon's two-site data that was presented at ESMO. We've seen updated data presented at SITC by Ahmad Sarniak from Moffitt of the TIL experience, highest response rate in second-line post-PD-1 failures. And the caveat should be that these were not just second-line. They were like third, fourth, fifth-line, seeing multiple checkpoints already, BRAF inhibitor already, higher LDH, poorer performance status patients. So that's a very strong indication of the role of TIL and T-cell therapies. Now, post-single-agent PD-1, there is data. Post-single-agent PD-1, there's data from Paolo Cierto of Rela-Nivo, where the response rates were about 12-13%. I showed our experience with fianlimab, cemiplimab, which was about 13%. Now, were there patients that benefited? Yes. We've got to really understand why those patients benefited and the others didn't. I showed data with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, about a 22% response rate. That has an NCCN designation, so you can utilize that. But the strongest data post-single-agent PD-1 failure is from Dan Olson, who is this wonderful colleague at University of Chicago, who worked with Jason Luke to do a randomized study and showed that there's about a 28% response rate of ipi-nivo post-single-agent PD-1 failure. So that's pretty much my go-to. If you haven't seen anti-CTLA-4 therapy and you can handle it, let's go back. What if you've seen Rela-Nivo and you go to ipi-nivo? There isn't a lot of data. Alex Menzies, great collaborator and pathologist from the Melanoma Institute of Australia, has some data that they sent to the New England Journal of Medicine of their experience. Again, it's in the teens. It's not as viable for me to go between combination to combination if I have T-cell therapies in the second line.
Can you comment a little bit about the data that we have right now on the use of lenvatinib pembrolizumab?
That was my last slide. In JCO by Anna Arians and others. This is it right here. What you can see here is a low complete response rate, paresis, low partial response, so about a 22% response rate and about a 70% disease control rate. Now, what is the progression-free survival? At 6 months, as you can see here, about half of the patients have progressed. So it's a six-month progression-free survival. And you can see, it's about a 50% 12-month overall survival. A lot of patients benefited here. I think I know that this is a regimen that you can get in the community. What's interesting here is that this can be a great backbone regimen that you can try and add things onto, with the caveat that when we tried to add VEGF-targeted agents to BRAF agents, there was severe toxicity. And with ipi-nivo, the concern for colitis makes it not something that you want to do.
So you mentioned renal cell, but also we discussed that combination lenvatinib pembro a lot in endometrial cancer. And one of the issues is the early toxicity that's associated with lenvatinib, the dosing of lenvatinib. And the gynecologic oncologists like to start with a lower dose, a lot of them, because they see a lot of hypertension, diarrhea. I'm curious what you your experience is with the regimen and how you approach dosing and particularly dose reduction.
Yeah, well, I have a huge experience with this drug, as we had this drug in phase one many moons ago at the Angeles Clinic. And I agree, it has a lot of toxicity. And I would defer to my colleagues who see other solid tumors who've had a greater experience with not only this, but sorafenib and other VEGF-targeted agents, including cabozantinib. And I've seen similar side effects, hoarseness, dysthymia, anorexia, et cetera, hair loss. And I don't utilize it in that way. I think we start with the higher dose, and then based on grade 2 or 3 toxicity would then decrease dose and would keep them at a decreased dosage. I have never found it efficacious to increase back up to higher dose because patients don't handle it. And clearly, our first thing is to preserve function and quality of life. And that's where some of these regimens sort of fall short.
So you mentioned also there's a trial looking at lenvatinib pembrolizumab in the first line setting compared to pembro alone. I'm curious what your thoughts are about what we might see in that trial. And I guess once we have the data, we'll have to compare it to IO LAG-3, right?
Yes, I agree. That's LEAP-3. I'm an investigator on LEAP-3, so that data hasn't been presented, and I can't really talk to any of the data there. I'm always for a regimen that can offer our patients greater options, and I would just wait for the randomized data to come forward. Do I think it's a huge paradigm shift? It can be, but it's coming into a crowded area, and what we've also really talked about is the toxicities and our reticence for our patients to, endure those toxicities when there are options that have been really proven for extended periods of time.
Any thoughts about when we might see phase 3 data?
It's upcoming. At one of the upcoming meetings, we should be seeing that data within the year.
Sounds good. Let's talk about your second case, the 45-year-old man with BRAF mutant disease. Again, can you talk a little bit about how you think through the management? So this is a patient who has a progression on ipi/nivo, then BRAF-targeted therapy. Can you talk a little bit about how you think through situations like this and what happened here?
Yeah, clearly... this is a patient that at the time that they were diagnosed was treated well. As we talked about, the data from DreamSeq indicates the utilization of first-line ipilimumab, nivolumab at full dosing for these patients. And then upon progression, the discussion is second-line what to do. More and more, we're realizing that the utilization of targeted agents, that those regimens, those combination regimens that target BRAF, whether it is... vemurafenib, cobimetinib, encorafenib, binimetinib, or dabrafenib, trametinib is being pushed into later and later lines and is being utilized at the setting of failure of multiple immunotherapeutic regimens, significant tumor burden, the requirement for a rapid response, etc. This is one where I would look forward to utilizing adoptive T-cell therapy as the first option for the patient. Now, is that available for all of our patients? No, pretty much no. Barring age and cardiopulmonary status, that's a significant thing to overcome. So, this is a 45-year-old male. Being part of that cohort of people in their 40s to 50s, I'd hope that they'd be healthy. But a 80-year-old with cardiovascular disease is not a patient to take to adoptive T-cell therapy. This patient is the classical patient where you would expect to have the ability to harvest tissue, and you would expect to have the time for the T-cell expansion to treat the patient. Now, where do we harvest tissue? There's data that's regardless of where you harvest, visceral, lung, subcutaneous, or et cetera, you get great tumor yield. And again, if I can just get on my soapbox here, these are data that has been shown in melanoma, but is promising in other solid tumors, whether you look at the cervical data, the data in lung cancer that's coming from adoptive T-cell therapy and other solid tumors. So now, what else? Well, the patient's got an NRAS mutation, and there are clinical trials that are looking at targeting NRAS with pan-RAF drugs. One of them was presented. It was a pan-RAF drug in combination with three different things. The pan-RAF drug with an ERK inhibitor that works downstream, pan-RAF drug with a CDK inhibitor, as many melanomas harbor those mutations, and a pan-RAF drug with a MEK inhibitor. And in the NRAS population, this was presented at ESMO 2022 by Celeste Lebe from France. There were greater than 20% response rates and durability in NRAS mutant patients. Hey, guess what? We talked about a patient who was immune suppressed. If this patient was immune suppressed, BRAF negative patient, they could come on. They looked at this combination in BRAF mutant patients. So this was our patient who had failed Ipi, Nevo, and failed the BRAF inhibitor combination and did not have other options. They would be a target for some of these newer drugs that are looking to target BRAF mutations, NRAS mutations, other RAS mutations that are common in melanoma. HRAS mutations are common, and there's targeted agents for that right now. So we're looking at building options for these patients and utilizing them in our specific cohorts where we haven't had options before.
What kind of toxicities and complications do you see with adoptive T-cell therapy?
Right. The majority of the toxicities you see are early toxicities related to the utilization of the lymphodepleting chemotherapy, right? So what is that? 100% of patients had grade 3 cytopenias. So with concerns about infectious, et cetera, the nausea, the alopecia, going forward. Some patients may have it might take a long time for their counts to recover, their lymphocytes to recover. The other toxicities you see are toxicities that a lot of us are not familiar with. When I was a fellow 2 decades ago working with Jeff Weber, we gave a ton of high-dose IL-2 as per the Atkins regimens for renal cell carcinoma and for metastatic melanoma. And we gave biochemotherapy, which is out of favor. But we were aware of those toxicities, hypotension, altered mental status from cerebral edema, organ failure, renal insufficiency, et cetera. And most people coming out of fellowship and training right now have a poor experience with IL-2. They haven't utilized it given our successes in those solid tumors where we use IL-2. But if you can go back to the toxicity slide I showed, the majority of the toxicity is within, you know, the time that is before or after the TIL therapy. And months, a month out, 6 weeks out and further, there are few, if any, long-term toxicities that pop up. There are no novel toxicities. There isn't a toxicity that we haven't seen before that we can't treat. And again, this is a therapy that is on its way, hopefully, to be FDA approved shortly. That is a one-time therapy where you can get complete response, deep partial responses that obviate the need for further therapy.
So I was just flashing on what it must have been like to be a fellow with Jeff Weber.
Well, it's somewhat like getting in to do this talk with Neil Love. You got to get up early, round on your patients early. You got to show up in a suit and tie, even if you're post-call, and you got to know your stuff. That was a very lovely time working with Jeff. And the habits that he imprinted in me still remain today.
So I was just also kind of flashing of what's going to happen once the first line Pembro-Lenvatinib trial reports, if it's positive, which seems like it's not, you know, unlikely. It's already, to me, pretty confusing just with Rela-Nivo, and now you're going to add in another option with more coming along. So looks like melanoma is, if anything, it seems to be really picking up speed in terms of complexity.
Yeah, I think at the parallel, on a parallel highway, as we're picking up speed in complexity, we're picking up the idea of, you know, utilizing correlatives to tell us what to do. And you remember when we talked about Succumbit, I told you that the strongest benefit of Succumbit is that it is a trial done by a motivated investigator who has done a fairly big trial. It's under 200 patients, but there will be hopefully correlatives, predictives, something that can help us move forward. We have been so focused on bringing clinical benefit right away to our patients that now we need to go back and understand the work we did and what is the messaging that is, you know, a couple of layers below just response and survival.
The other thing I'm thinking is this whole first-line metastatic thing is and particularly in terms of immunotherapy, is going to be complicated by a new generation of patients who had adjuvant IO. And how are you going to factor that in?
Oh, absolutely. That is a, I think at this time, we're trying to identify those patients and how to refer to those patients, similar as how we're identifying how to describe patients who are on first-line IO, primary refractory, secondary refractory, relapsed, et cetera. We will have to identify those patients and their different subgroups. 30% of patients relapse while they are on adjuvant PD-1 inhibitor or within the first 6 months of receiving it. Those are different cohorts and those are different subsets. Now, where will we get that information? That information will come from studies like, I haven't given a shout out to Jason Luke, who is a, you know, big man in this field, looking at adjuvant therapy with high risk stage 2, which was randomized to placebo and then had crossover. And then also Alex Eggermont and the group at the EORTC who led Keynote 54, which did the same for stage 3 patients. What happens when you recur and you re-challenge? What happens to those patients that recur early, what they get? And we will start to pool that data in, and we're doing that now, and utilize meta-analyses to help form a roadmap for those patients. And as I've said before to you, my impression is that other therapies that we've talked about, whether it's the VEGF paradigm, whether it's the MTAC paradigm, whether it's the adoptive T-cell therapy, or where we go with NK cells in this tumor cohort, those will influence our regimens, even in the first line for patients who have seen adjuvant, neoadjuvant. Now, let me throw another wrench in there as we're winding down. Trials like Nadina and trials like ImmunoNED describe these for you, and trials like Morpheus and KeyMaker. So Morpheus and KeyMaker are utilizing multiple combinations in the neoadjuvant setting for our patients. So I've seen that the lag PD-1 paradigm with Rela-Nivo in the neoadjuvant setting, Dr. Amaria from MD Anderson showed a 50% pathological complete response rate and a 70% response rate in the neoadjuvant setting. There is a trial moving that into adjuvant and neoadjuvant, and there are trials moving in anti-CTLA-4 anti-PD-1 full dose or near full dose in neoadjuvant, adjuvant, and TIM-3 and others. So we may have exhausted that, and a patient will walk through the door and say, what else? And I will then put on this talk that we had and have them step out after our first-line trials that we're looking at.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hamid, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.